This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is Spencer Greenberg, host of the Clearer Thinking podcast and co-author of what just might be the last self-help book you will ever need. In The 12 Levers, the complete psychological toolkit for improving your life, Spencer and his co-author, Jeremy Stevenson, analyze hundreds of advice books and distill the most evidence-based psychological hacks they contain into a dozen techniques or levers for self-improvement, hence the title of the book. We talk about how approaches like cognitive behavioral therapy harness our ability for critical thinking, why learning how to understand and focus your mind and feelings are fundamental to real autonomy, and whether there's a politics to self-improvement. Here is The Reason Interview with Spencer Greenberg. Spencer, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. So this is kind of a self-help book of self-help books, or a taxonomy of self-help books. Talk about the process. What are the 12 levers, and how did you come to write a book about the techniques that can help us be better versions of ourselves?
Yeah. So for many years, I've been developing psychological tools for the general public that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have used them on our website, clearthinking.org. And throughout that, I'm always looking for, you know, useful psychological concepts to teach people about decision-making, about goal setting, about habits. But I had this feeling that I kept seeing patterns over and over again, but I couldn't quite put my finger on what it was. And my co-author, Jeremy Stevenson, he's a clinical psychologist that treats patients, and he's always looking for tools to use with his patients. And he had the same general sense. He kept seeing kind of the same thing. Often it would be talked about in different words or different phrases, but the same underlying concept. So we decided to join forces. And unfortunately, it took us about 5 years to do the project. But our idea was, we're going to go through the whole genre and try to find all of the psychological strategies for improving your life. And so we ended up going through over 100 self-improvement books, covering many of the most popular ones. We went through over 20 different types of therapy. And every time they gave a method or technique or told you to do anything, we extracted it, made this giant database of 500 techniques. And then we analyze it. We say, what's there? What are the meta patterns? And when we went through and categorized it all, much to our surprise, we found that we could put it all in just 12 underlying psychological strategies, which we call the 12 levers, which is also the name of the book.
Right. And I mean, strategies, or I guess I was thinking of them as techniques, but strategies. And what's different about this is, like, it's actions that these different books say, okay, this is you can take, or this is what you should take. I guess before we go into what some of the, some of those levers are, discuss a little bit, like, what was your favorite self-help book that you read, or what was the most memorable? Because this is a genre which is very deeply embedded in the American kind of literary tradition. Things like, you know, the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin is actually kind of a self-help book in many ways. And obviously your co-author, who brings a lot of really interesting kind of clinical experience. So it is in Australia, but Australia and America, for these purposes, is kind of the same place. These are countries where you are more or less responsible for how things turn out, or that's how we feel anyway. But what were some of the most memorable books that you encountered while doing the research?
So one of my favorite self-improvement books of all time is a classic. It's called Feeling Good by David Burns. It's quite an old book, and it actually really brought the idea of cognitive behavioral therapy to the general public. It was kind of unknown to the general public before that. And David Burns had this idea of, like, I can bring this to the masses. These techniques are being used in therapy and are seeing really good effect, but you can actually apply them in your own life. And that was really life-changing for me, actually, reading that book, because although I'm not prone to depression, and the book is really about depression, it has a lot of really useful tools that can be applied to all kinds of different problems. So that was one of the first times I read a self-improvement book, and I was like, yeah, this is what self-improvement should be. A lot of really useful tools that you can, you know, just concretely put into action.
And he was a was he an actual student or a protege of Aaron Beck, who is kind of considered the father of cognitive behavioral therapy, and CBT, as well as Albert Ellis's rational emotive therapy, or oftentimes rational emotive behavior therapy. They seem to be kind of in many ways the twin stars, right? They're the Castor and Pollux of this book. But talk a bit about what cognitive behavioral therapy or REBT, you know, what are they and why do they seem categorically different than older versions of psychodynamic therapy or counseling, which was, you know, maybe 70 years ago, you might go to a psychoanalyst and you would lay on a couch and talk about your deep latent feel or bring to the surface your, you know, submerged feelings about your mother, about your father, about memories that you barely remember.
So your history knowledge is impressive, though I'm not surprised by that, having watched your show before. Yeah, so Albert Ellis, and actually, as of recently, you could go watch the people following his footsteps actually do live therapy sessions in New York, which I've done a couple of times. It's very interesting. He noticed in his therapy sessions that often his patients had essentially irrational beliefs that were harming them. And so it wasn't just that, oh, they have this rational fear and, you know, this bad thing's happening, but they literally have an irrational belief that they can't let go of. And he started experimenting with things like shocking them by just telling them you're being irrational and just experimenting in different ways. But his, you know, one of his basic observations was if you could adjust these irrational beliefs, it could actually make people's lives better. For example, someone with who's prone to depression might feel like they're worthless and nobody loves them. But actually, people do love them, right?
They are deeply unlovable, right? That's the leap, that I'm rejected or a relationship ends, and that means I am unlovable and I will never be loved again. And then Albert Ellis famously would challenge people in therapy, you know, in an era when therapists were much more like, yes, tell me more, or, you know, what about your mother? He would just be like, that's insane. You're nuts. Why are you thinking that?
Yeah, and I think he was trying to shock the patient enough to like get them to shift. Although in modern cognitive behavioral therapy, they don't do that anymore.
Right.
Now they use much gentler approaches. So that was kind of controversial, but it was kind of onto something. And then Aaron Beck, I think, had similar observations. I remember reading a story about how he kind of one day when a patient was, you know, talking to him about their problems, and he was, you know, starting to use kind of psychodynamic approaches, he was just like, wait, but how do you know that's true? You know, and he just had this realization that maybe the psychodynamic approaches were not helping this person. Maybe he needed to challenge them. So I think they both hit on similar ideas. And that's kind of the C in cognitive behavioral therapy. Like but then there's the B, the behavioral. And that actually comes from a totally different school of thought. Behaviorism has kind of been around in different forms for a long time. But Skinner is one of the sort of big characters there, who did a lot of experiments trying to understand how animal behavior works and eventually apply it to human behavior. And, you know, at the end of the day, we are animals. We're not just animals, but we are animals. And the fact that we are animals means that some really interesting findings in animals apply to us, such as if we keep having the same trigger and then we have the same response, we will start having that response automatically. And see, he started studying this and figuring out ways that this could actually be used to help patients, especially with things like severe anxiety.
Yeah. So you guys both, early on in the book, you talk about moments where this applied to your individual lives. Could you speak on behalf of your co-author and yourself and just say, okay, what were the events that kind of put you into, you know, that helped you understand that I'm having kind of automatic responses, like reflex responses that I'm not thinking about, and I can actually change that and gain control over that?
Yeah. So my first experience of this was reading about cognitive behavioral therapy, and they made a claim that when you're really emotional, your thoughts get distorted. And I thought, I don't think so. I think I would have noticed that. Like, I've been living in my brain my whole life, right? So I was like, okay, but I'm going to do an experiment. And the next time I was feeling like really negative emotions, I wrote down my thoughts and I came back to them the next day, and rereading them, I was like, holy crap, they're right. Yeah. My thoughts were distorted. Like, I didn't actually believe them the next day. And that sort of opened the door to me and be like, wow, things going on in my mind are not necessarily what I perceive. And also, these distorted thoughts may be causing challenges for myself. So that was one of my big revelations, not the only one.
Yeah. And what about Jeremy? He talks about in the book about really not kind of measuring up to a standard Australian male kind of typology or something like that. And then dealing with that brought him to various recognitions.
Yeah, well, you know, it's history to tell, but I'll tell a very, very approximate version of it, which is that I think that he really was trying to get people to like him. You know, he would be in social interactions, and rather than acting authentically, he would be like, well, you know, and this wasn't so conscious, but he subconsciously was like, how do I get them to like me? And that was sort of his orientation socially. And, you know, I think a lot of people are like that because they really care about people liking them. But actually, you end up developing much weaker connections with people because you're not really being yourself. Like, they're not really getting to know you. And there's a sort of artificiality to the whole thing and the brittleness to the whole thing. And also, often, you end up not with the people you're most compatible with. Because, you know, if you act truly authentically, you find your true people that really like you for who you are. So one day, he was sort of reading a blog, and he just... something about what it said about how this behavior can be harmful. And it was exactly the behavior he was doing. And it just kind of, it shocked him. And he described it as literally, he kind of reeled back and like stumbled. It was such a shock reading this. And then that gave him the awareness to start noticing what he was doing in his interactions. And as he started noticing it, then that actually gave him a path out to start being more authentic.
Just to linger a little bit more on Ellis and to a certain degree Beck, Ellis, who for a reason audience, by the way, might remember that he wrote an entire book-length attack on Ayn Rand in the late 60s, accusing her, even though there are a lot of similarities in the way they think and the way that they behave, interact with people, but he thought that the way that she kind of conceived of and talked about objectivism, the philosophy she created was very cult-like, and it was a religion, which is, you know, is fighting words both to objectivists as well as to Albert Ellis followers. But one of the things he talked a lot about was that you should have radical self-acceptance, that's kind of the beginning of everything, that like you have to accept as a basic truth or the beginning of everything that you are okay. That you are a person who has a life worth living, et cetera. Does that is that kind of the foundation upon which all self-help ultimately rests? Of recognizing that you are okay as a person, regardless of who you are or what kind of situation you're in.
Yeah, there's a wonderful quote along the lines of, when you finally accept yourself for exactly who you are, then you can begin to change. And right. I think there's something to that. However, I'm going to push back on that and say, No, you don't have to accept yourself. You can just start improving. Mm-hmm. You can just make things incrementally better. You could still think you're a total piece of shit, but you can learn to communicate better, to be more assertive, to get more of what you want in life. And then hopefully you'll eventually not think you're a piece of shit, right?
Yeah. And you tell a story in the book as well about having a lot of social anxiety. And that you kind of pushed yourself to overcome that in a way that is kind of funny, actually. But like, so you did not feel comfortable engaging with people or talking to people. And what did you do to kind of confront that and kind of learn how to move through that?
I'd had social anxiety since I was a little child. I don't know where it stemmed from. Maybe it's genetic. Who knows? Maybe it was early life experience. But it would especially get triggered in situations where I'd have to go up to a stranger and talk to them. I would feel like the world was ending, like my heart would be pounding in my chest, like I couldn't think. I would be so frightened of those situations. And obviously it makes no sense. Like it's totally irrational, right? But it felt completely real. And anyone who has a phobia knows what this is like. Like, you know, you get so afraid, even if you know intellectually that there's nothing to really be afraid about. And in my early 20s, I was like, okay, I've got to do something about this. This is, you know, ridiculous. And I looked into like, what does the evidence say about what's the most effective treatment? And I ended up finding a therapist who practices evidence-based treatments. And he said, great, I can help you. You're not going to like what I'm going to tell you, though, how to help you. And I'm like, well, what is it? He said, you're going to go every weekend to a bar and you're going to go alone and go up to 5 strangers, one at a time, and you're going to talk to them. And I was like, are you kidding me? There's no way I can do that. But we started small, right? And we started with just ask them the time. Like that's bearable. I would get really stressed doing it, but it was bearable to ask them the time.
Yeah.
And then we go a little bit harder. Okay, ask what drink they're drinking. Just say, oh, what is that drink? It looks good, right? And then it escalated and escalated until I was, you know, challenging myself. And the very end, I would literally go up to men I didn't know and say, hey, would you mind giving me a hug? And yeah. My brain was like, I'm going to die. Like, my brain was like, they're going to kill me. The world's going to end.
I could see that happening, actually. But yeah, but maybe dying.
The funny thing is that, like, none of them had a bad reaction. Like, at worst, they would just laugh it off and be like, okay, no, buddy, or whatever. And, like, nothing bad happened. So, and it just worked stupendously well. Like, my social anxiety just went down so much. I'm not going to say I have no social anxiety today. I certainly do it in some situations, but I have so much less. And there are times now when I'm in situations where I think I have less than the average person in that situation, which is just kind of shocking given where I started.
And before we move on, like you mentioned, like, I don't know if I was, you know, maybe I was born this way or it was early behavior experience. You know, how do things like genetic predispositions or kind of, you know, just existing, I don't know if it's like blood chemistry, you know, or things like that. How does that play into your analysis of things? And then also something like using drugs, because I know a lot of people who, when they have anxiety, they take beta blockers. So like people who are uncomfortable speaking in front of an audience or something like that, or driving over bridges, they'll take beta blockers. And they're okay. Like, how does these types of things, either the etiology of a particular circumstance or feeling, or the, you know, a chemical fix, how does that fit into what you guys are talking about?
The research on sort of genetics and things like mental health disorders, it's not the sort of thing where you're like, oh, if you have this one gene, then you're depressed. If you have this one gene, you're anxious. I think early on in the study of genetics, people kind of thought that's what we'd find. And you do occasionally find that. There are some disorders that are like that, but most disorders that we care about are not like that. And mental health disorders are definitely not like that. And what you find is that if you take someone's entire genome and you kind of build a predictive model using every gene, you find like hundreds of genes contribute a small amount to the predictive ability. And typically you find a heritability of something on the order of 40 to 60%, you know, with some mental health disorders being a bit more heritable and some being a bit less.
But and yeah, that's also hard to know too, right? Because it could be that you're living in a family environment that, you know, is replicating psychological issues, right?
Well, the best studies try to control for that. They'll look at they'll look at identical twins. And they'll try to compare identical twins to fraternal
twins. We need more identical twins, right? There just aren't that many, but they get picked over a lot, right?
Identical twins are like incredibly useful for science. Yeah. They're like, I think probably all of them are enrolled in a study at this point because scientists seek them out so badly. But yeah, if you compare identical twins to regular siblings, you can do analyses that try to pull this apart. I will say there's a massive debate in the field of genetics about heritability, because there's another way to approach this whole thing, where instead of looking at twins, what you do is you try to build a predictive model from the genetics itself, and you literally try to predict the disorder. And what you find is a gap. You tend to find higher heritabilities when you look at twin studies and somewhat lower heritabilities when you try to predict from the genetics directly. And for a long time, people assumed that was like, oh, well, we just don't have enough genome sequenced and our predictive models aren't accurate enough. But then as they've gotten more and more sequenced and their predictive models have gotten better and better, the gap hasn't fully closed. So this is literally a giant debate in the field of like, what's going on there? Why is there still a gap between the two? So I would say that bizarrely, it's sort of unsettled science.
So what about, what about pills that fix things, you know, say something like depression and, you know, the effectiveness of things like SSRIs have really taken a beating over the past couple of decades. But also stuff like beta blockers. Are there pills that fix what ails people psychologically in a way that, I don't know, you know, like insulin helping a type 1 diabetic, process blood sugar or something like that? Or is it always a mix of chemistry and psychology?
So beta blockers are an interesting case because they don't handle the cognitive effects of anxiety, but they handle the physiological effects like trembling or, you know, sweating, things like that. And so they tend to be really useful for people who tend to get a lot of those physical effects specifically in performance situations. So, you know, actually people who perform in front of the public, you'd be surprised at how many of them will take a beta blocker to help, you know, prevent their hands from shaking and so on. And I've actually done that myself in the past, like when I had to give a TEDx talk and I was like in an unusual environment and I was working, you know, I I was worried about, you know, getting anxious during it. I took a beta blocker, and I think it helped in that situation. I think, you know, I think that's great. It has a specific use case, and I think it could be useful for that. A drawback of doing things like that is it can work against exposure therapy, where you're exposing yourself to the thing you fear until you no longer fear it, because it kind of gives you an aid and it says, oh no, you're only safe if you have the beta blocker. So I think long-term, if you're trying to cure anxiety, it can actually work against it. But if you just have a special situation, you're like, oh, there's one thing I just really want to make sure I don't, you know, my fear doesn't spike out of control in a way that affects me physically. Yeah, it could be really useful. SSRIs are a whole giant can of worms. So there's SSRIs and SNRIs and some other variants as well. You know, the most common people think about is like Prozac for SSRI. For SNRI, they think about something like Cymbalta. These drugs, they certainly help some people. And they can help with both depression and anxiety. What happened, if you look at the research, is the early research overestimated the effect size of these, so they looked more effective than they were, and underestimated side effects. Unfortunately, sexual side effects are really common with both of them. I don't know the exact numbers, but maybe even 40% of people are getting sexual side effects, which is not great. You know, it can be when you're depressed, you know, and this is not exactly something you want happening to you. However, they really do help some people. And even though the effect size is not enormous on average, what gets lost is that people try them. If they don't find them effective, they go off them. But if they do find them effective, they tend to stay on them. So the true effect size for those that stay on them might be something like twice as high as the average effect, because a bunch of people just, they don't work for, and then they go off of them.
And more to the point of the 12 levers and a psychological toolkit, it's also clear for some people, like going to a doctor and saying, I'm depressed, and they might say, you know, they might prescribe an SSRI and then say, see a therapist or recommend somebody. And it starts a process by which individuals are kind of taking control of their psychology, right? Which, again, you may end up not using SSRIs or doing this or that, but it seems, you know, one of the things that I find really interesting and powerful and relevant to, I think, my audience is the idea that what your book is about and what's so much of popular culture and popular psychology about is like, how do you figure out who you are, what you want to be, and how do you get there? And, you know, with that in mind, you know, just lever number one, and the book is structured in 12 chapters with different levers, but you talk about unraveling the causes. Can you talk a bit about what's the starting point of like when you buy the psychological toolkit and you're opening up the case and looking at it? How important is figuring out what the causes are?
It sounds really obvious, like, oh yeah, understand the cause. But the fascinating thing is that people often don't understand their own challenges at the deepest levels of causality. And a metaphor I like to use is, imagine your car won't start and you just start fixing things at random. You know, you fix one part, fix another part. Like, it could be incredibly ineffective to get the car to start. But if you do a diagnostic first, then you're like, oh, it's this. Boom, you fix it. Problem solved, right? So better understanding leads to better solutions. And if we think about this with a human example, imagine that you and your girlfriend or boyfriend like are finding yourselves getting in arguments a lot. And you feel like you understand it. You're like, yeah, well, she wants one thing and I want a different thing. But then you think about, well, but there are a lot of couples where one person wants one thing and one wants another thing. That doesn't really fully explain what's going on. Is there a deeper level of causality? So you go one level beneath that. And it's like, well, actually what's happening is when we try to have a discussion about it, we both get angry at each other. So we can't actually have a productive discussion. Okay, that's level two. But is there another level? Well, level three, why are you both getting angry? Is it something the other one's saying? Is it some deep underlying resentment? Okay, let's go to level four. Why do you have that deep underlying resentment? And there's an analog here to the five whys, which is a kind of a business phrase, which is, okay, let's say your factory is not as efficient as you want. Well, why is that? The first why is maybe the conveyor belt's not moving as fast as you want. Okay, but why is that? Second why? Well, maybe it's because it has to be stopped periodically. Okay, why is that? And so on. So I actually think it's really powerful to try to dig deeper, try to understand your challenges at a deeper level of causality, and then you can often fix them more effectively.
Is psychology becoming more like engineering? You know, because almost in the way you're talking about it and say, okay, let's shift from talking about human beings to a car or to a conveyor belt. I mean, and I'm not saying this in a tendentious way, but I mean, that's kind of what we're, you know, this is a big part of modernity, right? That we start to understand our minds as rule-bound systems. And they're incredibly complex, but they're models or they're computer systems or whatever. But is that part of what we're doing here? I guess even talking about a psychological toolkit, we're already deep in a mechanistic kind of worldview, if not necessarily a reductive one.
I like to balance between metaphors, and I think there's different metaphors useful for different parts of understanding yourself. I think a kind of mechanistic one is useful for understanding, like, hey, there's a situation that's not going the way I want. Let me break down that situation and try to understand its different elements. But I don't think that it's always useful. But another metaphor, I don't know whether you kind of call this mechanistic or not, a metaphor I like to use for emotions is a smoke detector. Because I think it's a really useful metaphor, you know, just the way that if your smoke detector goes off when there's a fire, that's really, really useful. It gives you important information. But if your smoke detector goes off when you're cooking every day, that's really unuseful and it's actually harmful and actually you're gonna learn to ignore it. And similarly, you could think of emotions as the smoke. You could think of emotions as the signal that the smoke detector is putting out, and they're providing you information. Your emotions are information, and then sometimes they go haywire and they start signaling all the time, and it stops being useful.
Right, and I mean, I know for myself, to the extent that I have had any kind of psychological growth over the course of my life, and I am, you know, Irish on my father's side, Italian on my mother's side. So that's like, there's a lot of emotion embedded, right? In whatever, whether it's genetics or culture, but like, you know, when you have a strong emotion, I always used to think, okay, well, that is the authentic me, right? Like I'm responding. I would not separate myself from the emotion. Whereas kind of what you're talking about is the emotion is not necessarily the deep you, but it's telling you something is going on here that is, you know, figuratively triggering you. And so it's a good idea to be able to step out of that situation and say, okay, what's going on here? Is there an actual fire, or did I just like, is the fish burning in the pan on the stove and setting off the smoke detector?
I think it's useful to understand there is no deep you. There's not like the, you know,
yeah.
People want to talk like the homunculus is inside you. And obviously I know you don't mean that, but I think your emotions are you, but there's so much more to you, right?
Right.
Like your emotions are you, your reasoning is you. You know, your reactions are you, your triggers are, you know, it's all you. And this part of you can be acting against other parts of you. Like if your emotions are triggering all the time in innocuous situations, it could be hampering all the other things you want to do, right? I like to embrace all of it.
And I mean, you talk later in the book in one of the sections where you're talking about understanding the idea of parts, you know, that we are, you know, I mean, on some level, we have a unified consciousness, right? That we recognize, like when we recognize the person we were in a picture from 10 or 20 years ago, and we know there's some kind of continuity, but at any given moment in time, we're this assemblage of parts. And would you dilate a little bit more on the idea that there is no deep you, or I guess, is it, there is no unified you? It's, you really are kind of the sum of different parts that you're constantly kind of jumping from one to the other.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, in therapies like internal family systems, they take parts very literally. Like you've got this child part and it needs to be loved and it feels unloved and it's acting out. And I think it's a mistake to take them too literally. Like we're talking, these are metaphors that are useful for understanding ourselves. I mean, what we really are, on some level, materialistically, is this chunky, you know, chunky, fleshy stuff. Okay, what we really are on a spiritual level, it's some totally other thing. There's no, I guess my point is, there's many ways to look at what you are, but I tend to look at it psychologically. That's my, you know, that's my focus. And from a psychological perspective, it can be useful to think of yourself as having these different parts that have different drives, right? There's a part of you that wants to be loved. There's a part of you that wants achievement, etc. And I like to put at the base of all of that, your values, or more specifically, your intrinsic values, which are the things you value for their own sake, not things you value as a means to an end. I think of that as a starting point. Yeah.
Yeah. Where do those come from? Or can we freely choose those intrinsic values? Or is that kind of loaded into us? Or, you know, is it like firmware or something? We come out of the factory with those things? Or is it, you know, is that something that therapy or, you know, a deep psychological you know, kind of inventory and philosophical inventory can change?
That's a great question. So if you think about a little baby, I think it already has some intrinsic values. Like it likes pleasure. It tries to get away. It doesn't like pain, tries to get away from it. But I don't think it has big abstract intrinsic values like achievement or something like that. So that means, if that's right, that means they must develop some time between being a baby and like being an adult. And I think they tend to stabilize. It's hard to say exactly when, probably in your 20s or 30s, they're pretty stable at that point. Occasionally they can still change. Like someone who has, let's say someone who's a complete atheist could have no intrinsic values around spirituality or God, and then they become a religious person and they suddenly get them, or the reverse. A religious person could become an atheist, but I think they tend to stabilize. What I would say is they come about through life experience. We also get them from our culture and the people around us, I think. But once they stabilize, the funny thing is, I don't think there's a reason to try to create new intrinsic values unless you have intrinsic values that tell you that your intrinsic values are bad or something. But it's like, on what grounds would you try to create new ones? Like, if you don't value something, why would you seek to value it, right? You just sort of value what you value.
We're going to jump around to some of the levers, but lever 7 is steward your thoughts. And this has to do with cognitive restructuring. And we've touched on this a little bit in, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, obviously, this big part. What is cognitive restructuring, and why is that so important to, why is that such a powerful part of a toolkit for how we kind of act in the world?
A lot of times we take our thoughts for granted. We just think our thoughts are our thoughts. If something happens, we have a reaction. And many people think they can't control their thoughts. Obviously, you sometimes can. You know, if someone said to you, okay, count from 1 to 100, you could do that. You know, you can gain control of your thoughts. I think the right way to put it is, you can't control the first thought when something happens, but you often can control the next thought, or the thought after that, or the response thought. And so stewarding your thoughts is really thinking about, well, what do you want your thoughts to be? There's a bizarre realization we had when writing the book. It's one of these things that's like really obvious on some level, but is like shocking on another level. Where does suffering come from, right? Well, you could imagine you could live in a world where things smell so bad that like most of your suffering is from smells. Thankfully, very few people live in that world. Or that things were so ugly around you that it was the ugliness of your visual environment. Most people don't live in that world. For almost everyone in our world, like, you know, suffering comes from one of two sources: either your body, like you have a physical ailment, like pain, back pain, whatever, or your thoughts. And then if your body's in good health and it's not hurting you, then your suffering is almost entirely coming from your thoughts, which is kind of shocking to think about, and kind of shows the incredible importance of being careful about your thoughts and actually trying to steward them.
But then, yeah, that idea that you can change them, as opposed to like learning to live with your thoughts the same way you might learn to live with plantar fasciitis or, you know, a rotator cuff problem or something, right? So what goes into that of, you know, how do you restructure your belief, you know, where, it, you know, and maybe it is not the I am unlovable. Universally unlovable, and that's why my relationship failed. But it is something like, I will never be happy, or I don't deserve, you know, success, or something like that. You know, can you kind of just briefly walk through, like, how do you get to a point where you start to, you first figure out what those thoughts are, you know, what those beliefs, what those voices in your head, what those parts are saying, you identify that, and then how do you start to change that?
Yeah, there's different levels to it, actually different approaches to it, but a good starting point is asking, what do you want the next thought to be? Suppose that you could craft the next thought after you think to yourself, I'm unlovable. And maybe you think to yourself, I'm unlovable, you know, a dozen times every day. What do you want to respond with? You could literally write it down. So the guidance I like to give is to make that next thought something that is at least as true as the original, but more helpful. It's not bullshitting yourself. It's not lying to yourself. It's like something you believe is at least as true, but more helpful. So if you think you're unlovable, if that's the thought, you might think, well, I know there are some people that love me. That might be at least as true to you, but more helpful, right? I know my mother loves me.
But then it's also all about behavior, right? Or it's about action. Because kind of what you guys are talking about is that it's, you know, it's important to understand thought processes, but then you have to do something constructive, right? As opposed to merely having a logical argument that you, okay, this makes sense, right? So how do you move from having new thoughts to having new actions?
Yeah, I think learning to change that thought is a precursor to then taking different actions. So maybe if you had the thought, I'm unlovable, and then you start kind of ruminating about how people don't love you and that you go into the spiral, you can write down that new thought. Well, I know at least my mother loves me, or whatever it is. It's true, at least it's true and more useful. You then actually can practice replacing it and see, make a game of it. How many times a day when you have that I'm unlovable thought, can you then respond with this new thought? And then doing so can actually break you out of that next spiral, right? Oh, okay, now instead of spiraling, I actually can just move on to something valuable. I've literally done this for myself. I'll give you an example. I sometimes will ruminate about past social interactions where I felt like, I feel like I could have behaved better in that situation. Like it was kind of awkward or something like that. And I'll kind of like stew on it and like replay the situation over and over again, being like, what did I do wrong? And it's really not useful. Like it doesn't like lead to something productive. It's just a waste of time. It's stressful, not a useful thing. Obviously it's good to learn from your mistakes, but this is a different thing. This is just ruminating. And so I was like, okay, what do I want my next thought to be when that begins to happen? I want my next thought to be, this is not how I want to spend my life, like replaying situations that I felt were awkward. That phrase I've now been practicing when I have that first thought of like, oh, I could have done better in that situation. I replace it with this new thought. And I find it really actually helps me break out of it and then skip the whole rumination. That's totally pointless, right?
Yeah. And you have the lever 12 is attention training, which is related to this, where you kind of suggest certain exercises to have, you know, have us all kind of have, you know, direct our attention. One of the metaphors that you guys use is your attention is kind of like a spotlight. So it can't be everywhere all at the time, and then you learn, okay, if you're fixating on something, like how to control that and move that. And it's funny. In the chapter on attention training, you tell people to go look at a particular video, which is called the selective attention test, which a lot of people will know already, which is where people are playing basketball, like black shirts and white shirts, and they're passing, and you're supposed to be counting how many times the white shirts pass the ball, and then somebody in a gorilla costume shows up, and a lot of the time you don't see it if you don't know. And I just want to say for myself, like I went, because she's suggesting I watch that video real quick. I did, and then it took me about 15 minutes to get back to the book because I was on YouTube, and then I went to another, and I was like, oh, this is like...
We're shooting ourselves in the foot by recommending that video.
Yeah, I mean, or well, I certainly was. But like how do you move through, okay, you start to recognize that our emotions are kind of, you know, that's meaningful information about who we are and about what's going on around us and how we process information. You start to think about, okay, what are your foundational beliefs and what are the kind of automated scripts that just start running every day in your life? And like you're bringing those to, you know, an explicit level so that you can kind of project them outwards and say, oh, okay, when people act this way, it's triggering a response that may have nothing to do with this particular situation. And I want to change that. Like, how do you get to that, to saying, okay, now I'm going to start moving my thoughts and my attention in a more productive fashion?
Yeah. So this brings us to the idea of like actually making a plan, right? It's often useful to kind of like be like, okay, I know I have this recurring problem in my life. It's happening again and again, whether it's I get stuck in these like rumination cycles that are not productive, or I get in arguments over and over again, the same argument or whatever it is, and making a literal plan. And an example of this for me was there's someone in my life who has tendency to be very negative. And so often we'll get in conversations and they'll end up being very negative. And I feel like they're not healthy for this person. Like it's sort of like spiraling together, where they're kind of like talking about these negative things. So I was like, okay, let me actually sit down and make a plan. Like, what is my plan to make this better? And I realized like I can actually redirect the conversation to topics that this person loves talking about that are joyful and that break them out of the spiral. And so now what I've been doing is when I notice them in kind of going into this negative mode, I'm like actually kind of start to redirect them. But the point here is just that I literally have a plan, right? And it kind of brings together these different pieces. Like you have to sort of understand the causality of what's happening.
Yeah.
And you break it down at sort of a micro level. And the more micro level you understand it, ideally, even at the level of thoughts, the better that plan can be. And then you can say, okay, now that I have a plan, I know when it's going to occur. I know what I'm going to do. And importantly, it won't always go to plan. So you could try your plan, but then sometimes it will fail. And that's useful data, right? You can kind of be a scientist about it and be like, hey, that my plan didn't work. I tried to redirect them to this positive topic and they redirected it right back to, you know, all these bad things in life. Okay, what went wrong there? You know, and then you update your plan.
Is the scientist kind of a model for, you know, what you guys would say is like psychological, maybe not psychological health, that's like a little too normative, but like, you know, it's a different way of trying to make your way in the world is by being a little bit of a scientist. There was a book a couple of years ago called The Scout Mindset, which, you know, used the metaphor of like, you know, you're scouting new territory and that's how you should move through the world. The scientist, I was thinking, he doesn't come up in this book. There was a fairly prominent psychologist in the mid-century America. I think it was based at Ohio State, named George Kelly, who came up with a theory called personal construct theory, which is that all of our problems are that we have kind of embedded assumptions about the world. And then we work really hard to minimize cognitive dissonance when things don't work out by maintaining our personal constructs. And so we become, the worse those are, the more removed from the world we become. And this, you know, it's very, in a way, it's similar to, you know, cognitive behavior therapy or the way Albert Ellis would talk in therapy and things like that. But is that scientist mindset of like where you have a bunch of hypotheses and you're like, I want my life to be different. And I think this is a theory or a hypothesis that will work. And you're just kind of testing that out and you're constantly getting data and then incorporating it into the next iteration of whatever your project is.
There's this remarkable thing about being a human, which is you would think that being yourself, that means you know yourself automatically. And we just don't. We have to often reason about ourselves to figure it out, right? Like, obviously, we have some introspective access. Like, you know, we can tell when we're feeling a certain thing, but we don't necessarily know what that thing means or why we're feeling it. It's kind of remarkable about how much we can miss about ourselves that we can go, you know, to age 40 and suddenly have a realization about ourselves. We're like, how did I not realize that? It's really quite amazing. And one technique I like to use for this, I call it the inner why technique. It's very, very simple. It's based on the idea that we have so many different thoughts every day, probably many thousands, but we forget almost all of them. So suppose you got an argument earlier in the day and then someone says like, well, why did you get an argument? You literally may not remember because you don't remember the thought that occurred that actually caused you to get angry. And you might, even worse, you might rationalize, you might like guess at why you were angry and be wrong. So the inner why technique is very simple. It just says, try to learn to notice the moment your emotion shifts. So the first part of it, if we treat it as a game, the first part of the game is just catch yourself whenever your emotion shifts. And practice and see how many times a day you can catch it when your emotion has a sudden shift. And then the second part is just simply ask, why did that just happen? And the funny thing is, when you catch your emotion shifting right away, usually only one thing has just happened in the last 20 seconds. So it's really easy to spot why. But the bizarre thing is, if you wait even 20 minutes, you actually have much less granularity and you may actually not really understand what's going on. So you could kind of train a greater self-awareness, which can then be bootstrapped into a greater understanding of yourself.
Here's a question for you. And I don't know if you did this kind of analysis, but did you look at the way that self-help books or the large motifs or themes or patterns changed over time? You know, it seems like a lot of people now say, you know, the problem in the world is that everybody gets participation trophies. You know, it's usually this negative energy is focused on younger people. But, you know, in my day, we were tough. And nowadays, now everybody gets everything the way they want. And is there a sense that self-help books have shifted from saying this is how you make yourself better to this is how you learn to accept yourself and recognize the world as being unfair? Because that seems to be undergirding a lot of anger in the world now, which is that it's not me that's the problem. It's the world that's the problem.
It's interesting. I don't know whether self-help books change or there's this just this filter where which ones succeed and then become famous change based on what a generation is looking for, right? If a generation is looking for being told, like, you've got to accept yourself and you need more self-compassion, then that stuff will rise to the top. Maybe all the other books are still being written, but, you know, they're not the famous ones. And then in another culture, it's like, no, you've got to work hard and do everything yourself and, you know, and then you'll make it. And then in another period, it's like, all, you know, law of attraction and you just need to manifest, right? So we do see these kind of funny phases where things come in and out. But it's also funny because you can trace a lot of these ideas, like, back 2,000 years. And it's so interesting to see how an idea from Epictetus in, you know, 50 BC is like being, you know, talked about again now as though it's something new.
Yeah, I mean, there does seem, I mean, this I think is also not to fixate on RET or REBT or CBT, but Stoicism is having a moment, particularly among men, but I think also among women. And that, you know, there seems to be a lot about that, which is, you know, the idea that you should concern yourself with things that you can change, things that are directly relevant to you, and that, you know, you kind of have to accept that the world is not going to be your best friend all the time. But, you know, is Stoicism, is it on the rise? And is it because it's kind of in sync with these other psychological tools that have also developed over the past few decades?
I think Stoicism is definitely on the rise. I remember checking Amazon for books on Stoicism, and I was like, couldn't believe how many there were. And this is an idea where we really trace it back, you know, to, you know, Marcus Aurelius and these folks way back. And Stoicism has a lot of great ideas, so it deserves to be noted. It's just funny that it kind of re-arises. But I think one of the most important principles of all self-help, Stoicism does a great job of talking about, which is that you really need to focus on the things that you can control. If you try to control the things you can't control, then best case scenario, you waste time. Worst case scenario, you make yourself absolutely miserable. And actually, we had a really like kind of striking realization as we were kind of thinking about this, which is, again, one of these things that's sort of obvious and trivial, but also I've never heard someone say it. And like, I think it has somewhat profound implications, which is there's only really four things you control at the most basic level. You control your body, you know, you can move around unless you're paralyzed. You control your communication, like what you say to people. You control your thoughts, but only partially, like you can control the response thought, not necessarily the first thought. And then finally, you control your attention. You know, if you're walking down the street, you know, one person might pay attention to the beautiful flower bed and the other person might pay attention to the dog shit right next to the beautiful flower bed. And that's going to have a huge impact, right? Just those four things. So then when you're thinking about improving something in your life, it can sometimes be useful to go back to those four things. Like, let's say you have this thought often that you're worthless, right? You can go back to those four things and you say, well, what can I do about this from the point of view of my thoughts? Well, I can learn to notice those thoughts about being worthless and I can develop a response thought. What about from communication? Well, I can stop putting myself down in front of other people. And maybe I can ask people, maybe I can ask my romantic partner to help support me in ways to help me bolster up my good feelings about myself. You can think about your attention. Are you paying more attention to all your failures and not paying attention to your successes? And then you can think of your body. Are you taking care of yourself? Are you treating yourself like someone that you love? Or are you letting yourself kind of waste away, right? So it's just a useful reframe, like, oh, wow, that's it. That's all you've got control over.
Let me, to kind of close out our conversation, I want to ask, are there political implications to the kind of psychological health that you and your co-author are discussing? You know, one of... You know, obviously, politics is a grim business, I think, or I say, obviously, politics is a grim business. But there's a lot of discussion, you know, that a democracy either flourishes or founders, I guess, on, you know, whether or not people can govern themselves. Are people being rational? Are people being, are they able to make, you know, basic decisions on how they should live their lives. You know, is there a politics to the 12 levers, or does that yield to a particular type of society?
Well, I would say a few things about that. First of all, I really like to start with values. And I think if you think about like sort of the best possible society, I don't think there is one best possible society. I think it depends on what values you have. There's a best society from the point of view of, you know, freedom and autonomy and achievement. That may be very different from the best of a safety and security society where it's, you know, the most important thing is being safe. And as long as you've achieved that, everything's great, right? And so I think it's the same at the individual level. Like we have different values from each other. Different people have different values and it's important for them to understand it. And so if they're trying to create their own perfect life, like it's going to hinge on their values. So I think that's one thing I think has a connection to politics. And then of course, our book is rooted in the idea that you're trying to improve your own life using the things that you have control over. And of course, many people are in shitty situations that they didn't have control over. You know, if you're born with HIV, you know, you didn't choose that, right? You know, we all didn't, you know, we're lucky to not have died in infancy, you know, like, so, you know, but I think it is worth talking about the levers you have control over because literally that's what you have control over. Yeah. It'd be great if society was improved, but you don't necessarily have the ability to do that, but you do have the ability to take action today to start making your life better.
It is horrifying to think that, as you were talking, I was thinking of the Michael Jackson song, The Man in the Mirror, where he pledged that he was going to start when changing society, he was going to start with the man in the mirror himself. And I don't know that that worked out very well for him. But although he's having a moment, right? People love his music and you can separate the art from the artist, I guess, or the, you know, whatever. I guess as a final question, what is, you know, if anybody who's listening, you know, they don't have to, they can buy the 12 levers and then it's like a meta, you know, narrative of all of the best things that self-help books have to offer. But if somebody is reading another self-help book, when should the bullshit detector come up in a self-help book? Where it's like, okay, this is not about actually improving yourself. This is about something else.
I'm someone who believes there's a lot of really valuable stuff in self-help, but there's also just a tremendous amount of bullshit. And so it's this funny dichotomy at the same time. And, you know, we tried to really gather the good stuff and write the book we wish we could have read and just gathered it all. But I think my bullshit detector goes off when someone says, look, I was just like you. I had all these hardships you had, but look, I pulled myself out of it. And with this one trick, you're going to solve everything. And it's just going to take you 30 days. And it's not going to take any effort. I call total bullshit on that. Like self-change is work. It's difficult. And you need multiple tools. There's no one tool that's going to solve everything. And there's a good chance, even if you use really good tools, the first tool might not work. You might have to adapt. The second tool might not work. You might have to go to the third one. I mean, with my social anxiety, it's silly because a lot of people could just go up and have a conversation with someone and feel nothing. But I felt absolute terror. So I had to go through months of absolute terror in order to improve it. And I think that's more emblematic of like self-improvement takes work. It's challenging.
It is. Yeah. And it's iterative, right? Where like, it's a little bit at a time. And then maybe eventually you'll recognize you're a very different person than you were 6 months or a year or 10 years ago. But you don't necessarily feel that on a daily basis. And I guess it's also really hard to empathize. And I'm not sure that this fits into the book per se, but to empathize with other people, because like, you know, some people have problems, you know, with alcohol. Other people have problems with food. Other people have problems with negative thoughts or whatever. And it's hard to, even when you're consciously trying to do it, it's hard to get out of universalizing your experience, right?
Yeah, you know, we're only having experiences from one mind. And so that's all we know of the world. So we kind of project that onto all kinds of things. But the reality is we're wildly different from each other. And, you know, you mentioned SSRIs, like Prozac. I mean, one person will take it and they'll feel quite a bit better. And that's fantastic. And another person will take it and they'll have worse anxiety.
Yeah.
So it's amazing, idiosyncratic. Like humans are just so different. And I think because social norms force us to act similarly, it actually makes it seem like people are more similar. You know, you go to a wedding and, you know, everyone's kind of politely talking and, you know, eating food at the buffet. Nobody's in the middle of the room naked screaming, right? You know, unless it's kind of one of those weddings. But I think we tend to underestimate how different we are from each other.
Okay, well, we're going to leave it there. The book is The 12 Levers, The Complete Psychological Toolkit for Improving Your Life. It's by Spencer Greenberg and Jeremy Stevenson. Spencer, thanks so much for talking to Reason today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. And also, I just want to say, if you enjoy this, I would love it if you check out my podcast called Clearer Thinking. And I had a great conversation with Nick on the podcast. You can listen to it if you like.
Yeah, it was a while ago, and I'm not sure how great it was on my part. On yours, yes, it's an excellent show. So
thank you so much, Nick.
Spencer Greenberg, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks.